Session number 13170.
Professor Hanbury Brown, Reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, please, how it was that you came to be involved with Bodsea Research Station?
Yes, I was postgraduate at the Sitting Guilds College of the Imperial College of London, doing postgraduate work in radio. Well, it was called telegraphy and telephony in those days. A course run by Professor Fortescue. And I was always been interested in flying, and I was a member of the University of London Air Squadron. In fact, I did their first flight for them. This, I think, was in 1935. Anyhow, I decided that I would like to be specialize in radio applied to aircraft, if possible, to combine an interest in radio with an interest in flying. And so I started my application to be an entry to the Royal Air Force, which was quite easy to do from the University Air Squadron in those days. And in the course of the meetings of the University of London Air Squadron, which had small offices in Exhibition Road, where we went for lectures on navigation and so on, I met Sir Henry Tizard several times. Sir Henry had been instrumental in starting the University of London Air Squadron, and he was very interested in it prospering, and so he used to come down in the evening sometimes and talk to us. And that's where I met him, and he asked me one day what I was doing, and I told him I was doing radio and postgraduate. Well, he asked me really why I'd done so much flying relative to the other members of the Air Squadron, and I said it was because I was postgraduate and therefore didn't have to go to lectures. And Sir Henry said, "I think I have a job for you," and I said, "I don't want a job because I'm doing a PhD. Sir Henry said, "You can do a PhD any time you like in your life, but this job is one which will only happen once, unlikely to be another opportunity like it." So that was the end of that. I thought he'd forgotten, but he hadn't forgotten. And so one day, several months later, I received a thing telling me to go to the Air Ministry for interview. And I attended, and I think there were 14 people, I can't remember. One of them was Gerald Touch, who was there at the same time, who later on, I think, became one of the directors of GCHQ. Anyhow, he was there, and we were both interviewed, and we were interviewed by Sir Robert Watson Watt and some other people whom I don't remember. Anyhow, we got a letter simply saying that we'd been appointed. I got one saying I'd been appointed assistant grade 3, and would I report to the Slough, Radio Research Board at Slough. I went there in July, I think, of 1936, and was interviewed by a man called Labouchere Hillier Bainbridge Bell, who was a well-known eccentric on the staff of the Radio Research Board, and he put me through a number of questions and asked me if I understood what a cathode ray tube was and so on. When I told him that I actually had one, because I had a small laboratory at home, he said, "Well, go to this place." And he gave me the address of Bawdsey Manor. Rather annoying, because I just fixed up digs in Slough, of course. However, I went back, cancelled all that, and drove to Bawdsey Manor. And that's how I got to Bawdsey Manor. Largely, you know, just contingency. I'd not planned to go. Tizard had promised me that if I didn't like the job, he would get me out of it in due course and back into the Royal Air Force, where I had intended to go.
In what way was this man such an eccentric?
You mean Bainbridge Bell?
Yes.
Oh, he was a bachelor, and I mean, he wasn't number one. He was the head man of that department was Robert Watson Watt. And then his senior people were Arnold Wilkins, Bainbridge Bell, and I think James Hurd. I'm not sure about that. Hurd, I think. Anyhow, Bainbridge Bell was an eccentric bachelor. He I mean, countless stories of him. He was frightfully fussy, a sort of, he loved designing new machinery and new electronic equipment. He was very keen on that indeed. I could tell you anecdotes about him, but I'm not sure you want them.
What did you find once you got to Bordsey?
Bordsey, I found this huge isolated manor with a small staff. I was number 14 on the total staff of Bordsey, surrounded by about 150 acres and guards, and on the east coast, of course, north of Felixstowe. And there I was... there was this small staff working on radar in the stables. The main installation of receivers were in the stables and of the manor house. The quilters who owned the manor house had only recently moved out, and the Air Ministry hadn't really moved in completely when I got there, but I don't think the quilters were still there, but they had only just left. Anyhow, what we did was we went by car, a sort of staff car, every day to Orford Ness, which is some miles away, quite a long drive really, and then across in a boat onto a pre-war airfield, a very windswept and deserted place. There was a lighthouse and 1418 war huts, which we occupied, wooden huts. And in these wooden huts, there was we did our work on radar. There were a number of masts there, which had been put up in 1935, that's to say 1 year earlier, by the original team that went there in about July 35, about 1 year before. And our job in a small group of people, led by a man called Dewhurst, I think there were four of us, and our job was to try out the wavelength of 13 meters. The original radar system had been developed on 26 meters, and that was what was being done at Bordsey Manor by, so to speak, the main group under A.F. Wilkins. We were another group under Dewhurst developing, trying to try out a new wavelength of 13 meters, because they had found that 26 meters on which the original work on radar was done was not satisfactory. There were interference, there were a lot of returns in the ionosphere, there were all sorts of troubles, and they thought a shorter wavelength would be better. So it was our job to make a new system on 13 meters. And we did it from scratch. It was a very isolated place. There was practically no test gear. There was very little technical direction because there were no professional, really professional radio engineers about. We were all young people. Bill Eastwood, George Willis, Donald Priest and myself, we were all more or less out of college. The man in charge of us, Dewhurst, was a middle-aged man from the NPL. He knew a certain amount about radio, but not very much. However, we were all keen radio amateurs, and we built a 13-meter system with help from the National Physical Laboratory, who supplied the receiver. And, oh, there was a man called Welpton there as well who ran the transmitter. That's right. There was a small section, of course, building the transmitter. We were divided into two groups, one building the transmitter and one building the receiver. And the transmitter was in charge of a man called Welpton. And we built a 13-meter radar system there.
How did 13 meters work out in comparison with the longer wavelength?
It worked out very well and was, in fact, finally adopted. We built it. We had to put in DF, of course, and sense finding and height finding. And in the receiver group where I was, we did all the work ourselves, but we did everything. Cleaning the huts, making the tea, lighting the fires, doing the theoretical calculations on the antenna system, building the antenna system, testing it, and then flight testing it. And when we got the thing working, we had regular flights from the RAF at Martlesham Heath, And we demonstrated the system to countless people, the Air Ministry and so on. And one of the most memorable, of course, was we demonstrated to Lord Rutherford, which was very entertaining.
Why was it so entertaining?
Well, it was entertaining because Lord Rutherford, Robert Watson, what came over, of course, because Rutherford was so important. He was then advising the government on defense. And we were all made to put on suits and ties and stand in a row and be introduced to the man. And then Robert Watson Mott explained to him the principle of the work. And, of course, unless you heard Robert Watson Mott, you wouldn't know what that means. But it's very difficult to understand what he was talking about, even if you understood the subject initially. He could make anything sound complicated. He used to use triple negatives, for example, in his grammar, which was rather difficult. Anyhow, when we took Rutherford to show him the actual echoes from the aeroplane, we had a run with the aeroplane at 15,000 feet or something, and it was a little late, so the aeroplane was just disappearing, and Rutherford saw this echo. I was showing it to him, actually, because there was only room for one person in the receiver. We had a sort of enclosure for the receiver, a wire screed place. And the old boy looked at this thing, and he said, well, where's it gone? Why is it so small? And I said, oh, well, if you wait a moment, sir, it'll get bigger and come back again. And Rutherford said, maybe, my boy, he said, but I want my lunch. I've never forgotten that. He walked straight out of the hut and went away. It was really rather amusing.
So this was about 36 that we're talking
about.
Oh,
I think this is 36 or 37. I think it's 37 we're talking about. 1937. The first demonstration of radar I took part in, we had to come back from Orford Ness. The first demonstration of radar to the Air Council and to the RAF happened in September 1936. And that was done at Bordsey Manor, and because they needed more staff to get the thing ready and to operate it, they had to temporarily borrow the staff from the small section at Orford Ness to increase the staff at Bordsey Manor. And I was one of the people sent to Bordsey Manor to help with this demonstration. So, you know, we rushed up and down the towers getting it ready and getting the receivers ready, and then I was one of the actual operators on the day. On the actual day of the demonstration, we had this rather elaborate transmitter which had been produced by a man called Mitchell, and which was unlike the original transmitters, which were simple transmitters, but this thing was a proper thing with a master oscillator and amplifiers and all that sort of thing. And we had this receiver. We had three receivers in parallel attached to the 240-foot mast with the dipole system, cross-dipole systems at three different heights, I think. And then flying boats and a large force of flying boats, I don't know how many, were sent out from Felixstowe, where there was a marine air base. And they flew across the North Sea, somewhere to Norway, I suppose, or somewhere like that. And then they staged this mock attack on Bordsey, on the coast. And it was our job to demonstrate the use of radar for detecting these aeroplanes and reporting the results to Fighter Command at, I think, Bentley Priory. And so we had three observers in parallel, so to speak, watching cathode ray tubes. The range, of course, of the aircraft was read directly off a scale on the cathode ray tube. It was what's called an A-scan. And the bearing was found by turning a goniometer and then finding a minimum and reading that as a bearing and reporting that, and so on. And we sat there, and behind us we had the Tizard Committee and some members of the Air Council. We had Lord Swinton, We had Whimperis. We had Sir Hugh Dowding. We had probably Professor Blackett, I can't remember, and a number of other big shots. And Watson sort of walked up and down giving them a talk as to how wonderful the system was going to be and what it would do. And time went on, and we didn't really see anything very much for a long time. It got rather embarrassing. And eventually, in the far distance and in the silence, because Watson Water then stopped explaining what was happening, you could just hear the faint hum of aircraft engines. And then at the same time we began to see faint echoes, and we rapidly took one or two measurements and passed them to fighter command before the aeroplanes roared overhead. I think it was the worst demonstration of radar probably has ever been given, because in point of fact, a good sound locator would have done better. And of course, the whole purpose of the radar chain was to replace the large project for a sound locator chain in the Thames estuary, which was underway, and which in fact had been held up because of the promise of radar. And here was this demonstration in which we actually heard the aeroplanes at the same time as we detected them. The performance was absolutely awful, and it was really quite embarrassing. And
should it have been better?
It should have been better, and the reason was there was, of course, an emergency meeting that evening, and everything was reviewed. And Bowen and somebody else, I can't remember who, probably Gerald Touch or something, went to Orford Ness and resurrected the original transmitter, which the people had built there in 1935, which was known to give more power, because the diagnosis of the trouble was that the transmitter was not giving any power. And anyhow, he came on the air on, I think, by Sunday, or it was all this happened on a Friday, I think, and anyhow, by Sunday he'd got the thing working, and we were getting better performance. And by Monday, the whole thing was working much better, and the main transmitter, which had been not putting out much power, had been put more or less right, as I remember, and we were getting ranges like 50 and 60 miles on these aircraft. And those positions were sent through to fighter command. And so the rest of the exercise was not that bad. But the first original demonstration to the Tizard Committee and the Air Council could not have been worse. In fact, it was so bad that it very nearly brought the whole business to a stop. The Chief of Air Staff, according to Watson Watt's book, I don't remember this, but the Chief of Air Staff came down himself and talked to Watson Watt about this exercise, and Watson Watt managed to persuade him that there was some trouble with the transmitter and so on, and that it was all right, and that the system was perfectly good, and in fact, it just got by. In 1937, 1 year later, there was another set of exercises in which about five radar stations were used, and that gave much better performance.
Were you in on that one personally?
Well, at the time that happened, I was in Dunkirk in near Canterbury, where we were installing a 13-meter radar station. And I was sent for to analyze the results, because they needed someone to analyze the plots from the five radar stations. There was some difficulty about the fact that the same aeroplane appeared in different places as reported by different radar stations. And I looked at all these things. There was a man called B.G. Dickens came up. He was the expert on air exercises from Biggin Hill, where they did all the original interception trials. And he came up to show us how to do this analysis. And I looked at this analysis and saw his fairly sophisticated methods of analysis, and I said, look, this data is not worth analyzing, something is wrong with one of these stations, Canewdon or it wasn't Bawdsey Manor, but one of the stations got something wrong, and in fact, I refused to do the complicated analysis because I said, what you want to do is send someone down to the radar station and put the thing right. And so this wasn't accepted, and so I asked to be transferred to a different job, and that is why I went into the airborne radar section and joined Dr. E.G. Bowen in the early development of airborne radar. There were about four or five of us, and I joined them in about 1930, the end of 1937. And that's how I got into the airborne radar section.
This is still at Bawdsey?
Oh, yes, at Bawdsey Manor, yes. The development of airborne radar is very interesting because, in fact, it is the only, we were the only group in the world developing, as far as I know, developing airborne radar at that time. It had been realized that in air interception, although you could detect airplanes at, by ground radar, that if you were going to get them in the dark, you would need radar on the airplane to close the gap, so to speak. It had been realized, and so Watson, Watt, and so on had sketched out a plan for developing radar and putting it in the airplane. Well, at the time that this was sketched out, was say in 1936 or 7, the size of a radar, existing radars, ground radars, had filled a large room, and the problem was to put that into an airplane. And this job was given to Dr. E.G. Bowen to do with a small group. And it was, of course, difficult because the problem was that in order to reduce the antenna, the first problem was to reduce the antenna size on aircraft, you had to use higher frequencies, very much higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths than were used in ground radar. And there simply weren't suitable valves available for this purpose to develop the satisfactory transmitter power available in England. And Bowen, not that was not the only thing that was missing. There were all sorts of other problems, like the fact that there were no suitable components for high altitude, and cathode ray tubes, for example, vibrated, the electrodes vibrated and they didn't focus properly in airplanes when the engines were running, and there were no solid dielectric cables to communicate with the power and the receivers with the aircraft antennae. There were no AC supplies in aircraft. There was only very variable DC supplies available. There were a whole lot of components which were later we accept as being inevitable, so to speak, were not available at that time. However, Bowen started work on airborne radar, and by the time I joined his group, there were two main applications of radar. One was called ASV, which was the air surface vessels, that's to say the detection of ships from aircraft. And the other one was called AI, the detection of other aircraft, bomber aircraft from fighter aircraft. The detection of ships had arisen because in the early tests of airborne radar, which was originally meant to be aircraft to aircraft, they had seen ships off the coast at Felixstowe. They thought, ha, this is a good application. So that's how ASV came to be started. And at the time that I joined Bowen, ASV was in fact the main application. We were trying to find out how to do it. You could make a system which looked just forward in the aeroplane and told you whether the thing was on the left or the right, or you could make a system which looked all round the aeroplane with a rotating aerial. And you could make a system with a narrow beam looking out sideways, which just swept the piece of sea and detected the airplane and ships in it. There were three main lines, and what we had to decide is which line to follow. So we built systems to test all of them. We put a spinning dipole underneath the Avro Anson. We put Yagi directional antennas out of the windows of an Avro Anson. And we also built a system with two simple antennae, directional antennae looking forward to the aircraft. And we demonstrated all these three systems to the appropriate officers of Coastal Command and the Air Ministry. And it was decided that the thing to do was to have the simple forward-looking system to start with, because the other systems were not so satisfactory and they were very difficult to put on aeroplanes. Well, AI was pursued at that time second priority, but it wasn't delayed because everything that we had to do to make ASV work was in fact beneficial to AI, except, as it later turned out, we chose the wrong polarization, which is a very important point for AI. We chose horizontal polarization for ASV in order to minimize the reflections from the sea. But as it later turned out, AI needed, for more complicated reasons, vertical polarization. And in fact, the great thing that made AI practical, so to speak, well, one of the things that made it practical in the transition between AI Mark III and Mark IV, Mark IV was the final system that really worked, was the change from horizontal to vertical polarization, which happened in 1940, much later. Anyhow, in 1939,